From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Holy Wars from the turn of the first millennium, we talk about the Crusades with James Reston Jr., author of Warriors of God. Also, we talk with film director Jules Dassin about New York before and after the attacks. He directed The Naked City, one of the first films shot on location in New York. He also made Rififi, Top Cappy, and Never on Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Pentagon says U.S. military action is continuing tonight in Afghanistan, though on a smaller scale than the strikes last night. Pentagon officials say today's strikes involve fewer than half the aircraft used yesterday. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
15 bombers and 25 fighter jets took part in the first round of airstrikes. For the second night, just 5 bombers and 10 fighters. The number of cruise missiles fired dropped from 50 to 15. The second round focused on new targets not hit in the first round. A senior Pentagon official says the cutback shows there just aren't a lot more targets to hit in Afghanistan. If damage assessments show that some targeted facilities were not destroyed, those sites could be hit again, but that assessment process is not moving quickly, and Pentagon officials say they still don't know for sure how many second strikes will be attempted. Air Force General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters he was generally pleased by the bombing results of the first night, but at that point he had only seen damage reports from about a third of the sites targeted. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
There were protests in several Arab countries today, even as moderate Arab countries offered no comment on the airstrikes in Afghanistan. In Egypt, security forces were on high alert as students staged nonviolent protests. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
At Cairo University, armored vehicles and National Guard surrounded the campus, and students kept their protests indoors. But there was widespread unhappiness with the airstrikes. This student, who gave his name as Hani, said no matter how many times Americans insist this is not a war against Islam, Muslims get upset when people attack one of their countries. The airstrikes were very bad, very aggressive, he says. We are not standing with Afghanistan because we agree with their policies, but because it's an Islamic state. The government, meanwhile, repeated its muted comments of recent days. Foreign Minister Ahmed Maher said a war against terrorism should not be a crusade against Islam. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
A second anthrax case has been reported in Florida. A co-worker of the Florida man who died of anthrax last week has tested positive for the disease. Attorney General John Ashcroft says he's concerned, but doesn't know if the anthrax cases are linked to last month's terror attacks. Authorities sealed off the Boca Raton headquarters of the tabloid newspaper where the two people were infected after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta said the bacterium that caused anthrax might be present. New York Stock Exchange Chairman Richard Grasso today expressed confidence in the stock market's ability to bounce back. Grasso points to previous wartime dips and post-war rebounds. He says markets go down temporarily based on emotion, but they go up based on fundamental principles. Today on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 52 points at 9068, volume 965 million shares. The Nasdaq was up a fraction at 1605, the S&P 500 down 9 points. This is NPR News. Law enforcement agencies have been warned to stay on high alert in the wake of the U.S. military action. But travelers are still taking to the skies. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
The nation's airports are not super crowded, but thousands of people are flying. At Port Columbus International, many say they're just a bit worried about suicide hijackers, but they feel calmer seeing the beefed up security.
Life goes on. This is about our sixth flight since September 11th. We were in Spain at the time and we've kept going.
I really think the airports are probably the safest place now. If they try terrorism, I think it'll be somewhere else.
I do feel differently than I did Friday. Friday, it didn't bother me a bit. But this morning, I got up and watched the news, and I do feel apprehensive, not scared.
Now patrolling Ohio's six busiest airports are 100 National Guardsmen, armed with pistols. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Air Force fighter planes escorted an American Airlines jetliner back to Chicago today after a passenger caused a disturbance in flight. From Chicago Public Radio, Robbie Harris reports.
The pilot reported the disturbance and the situation was declared an emergency. Two F-16 fighter planes escorted the Boeing 767 safely to the ground at O'Hare International Airport. A passenger who was sitting next to the man told a Chicago radio station at one point the man jumped up and yelled something to passengers and then began praying. He then headed toward the cockpit. She said people on the plane grabbed him and subdued him. The plane was carrying 9 crew members and 153 passengers. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Harris in Chicago.
I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few days after the September 11th attacks, President Bush said about the American response, "This crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while, and the American people must be patient." His use of the word crusade outraged many Muslims. The new book, Warriors of God, explains why. It's a history of the Third Crusade, written by James Reston Jr. He's also the author of The Last Apocalypse and Galileo. There were 5 major crusades. Reston writes, "The crusade stretched over a period of 200 years, unleashing a frenzy of hate and violence unprecedented before the advent of the technological age and the scourge of Hitler. The madness was initiated in the name of religion by Pope Urban II in 1095 to redirect the energies of warring European barons from their bloody local disputes into a so-called noble quest to reclaim the Holy Land from the people they considered infidels. Once unleashed, the passion could not be controlled." I asked Reston to explain more about why the president's use of the word crusade got such a negative reaction.
Well, that was probably the worst thing that that Bush could have said, because the Crusades are remembered to Arabs almost like the Holocaust is remembered to the Jews in Israel. You remember when the Pope went to Israel several years ago. The big question in Israel amongst the Jewish community was whether or not he would apologize for the Vatican complicity in the Holocaust, which he did in a manner of speaking. But the Palestinian community was waiting to see whether he would equally apologize for the Crusades. And it's, I think, for a Western audience, very unusual and almost unbelievable that for the Arab world in general and the Palestinians in particular, that the Crusades of the 1100s through the 1300s are remembered almost as vividly as anything else in their history. And it's remembered, of course, as an attack and an invasion by Europe of the Middle East, in which a great many tens of thousands of Muslims were massacred. And in the very first crusade, which captured Jerusalem, the Christians came over the walls of Jerusalem and proceeded to slaughter many thousands of Muslims before they dropped on their knees in the Holy Sepulchre and gave thanks to Christ. So the notion generally of a Western crusade against Arab peoples and the Middle East is probably the worst image that could be evoked.
Your new book, Warriors of God, is about the Third Crusade. What was that crusade about?
Well, the First Crusade, which captured Jerusalem, put into being a state called the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which was not all that much bigger than the current state of Israel. It was a little bit larger, but basically had the same configuration along the coastline. And from the Arab perspective, the era of history after the capture of Jerusalem and the establishment of this European state, the goal was to consolidate Arab forces in Egypt and in Syria to surround this kingdom of Jerusalem and recapture for for Islam, their native land and their holy sites, because of course Jerusalem is just as holy to Islam as it is to Christianity. And what happened was that under the great Arab leader Saladin, in fact, the Crusaders were defeated, and Jerusalem was recaptured for Islam. And that sent terrific shockwaves through Europe, the loss of Jerusalem and the collapse of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And that's what made Richard the Lionheart fall to his knees, and all of Europe mobilized for the Third Crusade.
The Arab army under the direction of Saladin had seized the True Cross. What was the True Cross? What was its significance?
Well, of course, this was thought to be the true cross, the cross that Christ was crucified upon. And it was, there's great controversy as to whether it really was the true cross or whether these pieces of wood that were kept in the Holy Sepulchre actually were the true cross that Christ was crucified on. At any rate, the Christianity at the time thought it was. And they would trot it out when they had a great battle against the Muslims, and it had always worked up until the year of 1187. It seemed as if whenever the True Cross was brought onto the battlefield by the Crusaders and the Christians, that they always won their battles. Well, they didn't win the one in 1187, and the True Cross, or whatever relic of that cross was in the Christian camp, was taken by the Muslim forces, and it became a bargaining chip in the years that succeeded that.
You say that the Muslims then revered Christ as a true prophet, but had contempt for the story of the crucifixion. Would you explain that?
Well, the Islam feels that the story of crucifixion is unworthy of a great religion. The notion of a God actually dying in human form and then being resurrected. They believe that Christ that there was a substitute for Christ, and that Christ was not really himself, was not really crucified. They just simply feel that it's unworthy. And they don't believe it as it's told by Christianity.
How important was the seizing of that cross to the mounting of the Third Crusade?
Oh, I think it was one of many things. It's much more important than that, of course, was the collapse of the Crusader kingdom and the loss of mm-hmm. Jerusalem and the loss of the holy sites. The loss of the True Cross went along with that. But I think that's a secondary. It's a secondary question. It's that, you know, what's going on today between the various religions in the Middle East really has its roots back 800 years ago, and many of these same issues were fought over just as violently and just as intensely as they are today.
How did Jerusalem change in the Third Crusade when it was recaptured by Muslims?
Well, this is interesting because Saladin, while thought of as a great warrior in the Arab world, is also very well known for his generosity and his sentimentality. This is something very much in direct contrast to the way in which the image of Saladin is used today. But when, as I said before, the first Crusaders came over the walls of Jerusalem, they slaughtered whatever Muslims and Jews they could find within the old city. By contrast, when Saladin took the city, there was no massacre, and there was a great debate within Saladin's inner circle about what to do about the Christian holy sites. And it's very clear in the medieval chronicles that Saladin basically overruled the whatever was being proposed by way of just decimating the Holy Sepulchre and the other Christian sites, and says very clearly that it's simply not to be a good Muslim to defile another religion. And this is this sort of attitude, not only of generosity towards those that he defeated, but it's actually a criticism of him that he allowed the Christians who were in Jerusalem to leave the city and to go north, and in fact protected there these refugees going north, and instead of driving them all completely into the sea. And this came back to haunt him later, because you know the city of Tyre remained in Christian hands, and that gave Richard the Lionheart a toehold when he came.
How did Jews fare under the Christian rule and the Muslim rule of Jerusalem?
Well, the Jews fared very poorly under the Crusader kingdom, very poorly under the Christians, and fared very well under Saladin. I mean, this is another interesting irony in relation to today's world, that Saladin was very generous to the Jews, invited them back into Jerusalem, and had Jews on his staff as his physicians, it's very, very clear from the historical record that the Jews felt very, very well towards Saladin.
My guest is James Reston, Jr. His new book is called Warriors of God. It's about the Crusades. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, James Reston, Jr., is the author of a new book about the Crusades. It's called Warriors of God. When Christians and Muslims were fighting over control of Jerusalem back in the 1100s to the 1300s, what was at stake for each of them? What were the claims they each had to Jerusalem?
Well, Terry, it's very interesting to research a book like this. Here's an 800-year-old story. Research a book like this in the Middle East, and to talk equally to Arab scholars as to Western scholars. It's almost emblazoned in the Western canon that there were five Crusades, and everybody's a bit confused about which one was which and what was more important, and they all get kind of lumped together as the same thing. From the Arab standpoint, it's looked at quite differently. It's looked at really as a three-stage process, not five battles or wars. The first is the loss of Jerusalem itself with the first crusade in the year 1098, and the establishment of the European Kingdom of Jerusalem. That's phase number one, that terrible blow to the Arab world. Phase two is an 80-year effort to consolidate these very disparate tribes of the Arabian world into some sort of a consolidated force that could recapture the land which we now know as Palestine. And this is a very slow but quite steady process in which the great effort is to consolidate Egypt and Syria, and then to fall upon the kingdom of Jerusalem and defeat it. That's phase two, that consolidation process as the Arabs see it. And phase three is the great triumph of Saladin, where that goal is realized in the defeat of the Crusaders and basically the pushing of the Crusaders and the Europeans into the sea. And of course, that's the reason that Saladin lives so vibrantly in the Arab world today, because he's the great hero that drove the Europeans out.
Was the word jihad used during the Crusades?
Yes, it was.
How is it defined then?
Well, it's defined more broadly than we think of it today. To begin with, it is of its nature a defensive concept. It is the protection of Islam. Now, it has been misused subsequently to refer to the proselytizing of non-Muslims. I mean, the Muslim movement after Muhammad became a very, a very military one, and Islam spread across North Africa partly by military force. But the original concept of jihad is the protection of Islam against assault from the outside.
And that's the context that it was used in during the Crusades?
That's correct. I mean, it was the Crusaders had invaded Palestine, and that was, and had taken that vast area of the coastline there, and jihad was called in order to recapture what they thought was theirs.
Did you go to the Quran and try to read how jihad is used in the context of the book?
Yes.
What'd you find?
Well, it's as about as I described it, but I think also it was interesting to me when I was in Syria researching the book to find that jihad can also be applied in a personal sense, that one can have a jihad of the tongue, for example, that keeps a good Muslim from blaspheming. And it can be used in other personal ways that attempts to purify the personal behavior of a Muslim. In other words, it doesn't have to always be applied as a national or militant concept for states or peoples.
You did interviews in the West and interviews in the Arab world as part of your research for your book on the Third Crusade. What are some of the different perspectives you got in the Christian world compared to the Arab world?
Well, the central one was what I mentioned before about the different way in which that Crusader period, as we know it in Western, the way Western history is written, how differently that is viewed as Arab history. That's the central thing. Beyond that, of course, the Crusades in childhood lore, and I certainly had plenty of this when I was growing up, is thought to be the age of chivalry. And Richard the Lionheart was very much a part of the Robin Hood lore and the noble heroic quality of crusaders returning from their noble quest in the East to their homes. All of that was great stuff of childhood bedtime stories and little movies that we used to see when I was quite young. So there is, of course, none of that in the Arab world.
And do you think that there's still a grain of truth to the nobility of the knights and so on, or do you think that that's really mythology?
Well, it is mythology, but, you know, we love mythology, more often than not, there is a grain of truth to mythology. I suppose to some extent in the internecine fights between the knights of one province against another, there was probably some chivalry on the battlefield. But when the Crusaders moved to the Middle East, I think the notion of chivalry on the battlefield pretty well went out. Richard the Lionheart, one of the first things that he did after his first great victory in Palestine when he overcame the siege of Acre was to pull out 2,700 Muslims out of that city and massacre them. So there's no chivalry in that at all. And actually, if one's looking for chivalry in the Third Crusade, one finds, I would say, marginally more amongst the Muslim forces, and particularly Saladin himself, than in the Christian forces.
What are the ways in which your research into the Crusades have informed the way you interpret what's happening now in terrorism and the coalition against terrorism?
Well, Osama bin Laden no more represents Islam than Jim Jones or David Koresh represents Christianity. I mean, Osama bin Laden is a perversion, an aberration, and we're going through this very sad period in America where it all gets lumped together from the American, particularly white American Christian standpoint. But Osama bin Laden is a cult and a perversion, and there is actually a very good parallel to what Osama bin Laden is from the Third Crusade, because there was a cult at that time also called the Cult of the Assassins, and it was led by a figure called Rashid al-Din Sinan, and the Assassins had a territory deep in the mountains of Syria, and they basically terrorized all of Palestine. But they were in no way representative of established Islam. It was a sect and a perversion of Islam. And yet they used the technique of political murder to great effect, with actual assassinations and attempted assassinations, including an attempt on Saladin himself. So instead of us thinking about Osama bin Laden as representative of anything in a broad scale, I think we need to think of him as an aberration who is really a direct descendant from the so-called old man of the mountain who presided over the assassins of the 12th century.
Well, Jim Rustin, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
James Rustin Jr. is the author of Warriors of God. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story behind one of the first films shot on location in Manhattan. We talk with the director, Jules Dassin, who returned to New York from his home in Greece after the attack on the World Trade Center. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people have canceled travel plans, but not film director Jules Dassin. Although he's 90 years old, last week he made good on his promise to come to New York for a film retrospective produced by the Film Forum in downtown Manhattan, featuring the work of his late wife, the actress Melina Mercouri. Dassin directed her in the films Never on Sunday and Topkapi. He lives in Greece. He's lived abroad ever since he was blacklisted in the 1950s. While living in France, he made the classic film Rafifi. In the 40s, before he was blacklisted, he made Brute Force, Night in the City, and The Naked City. The Naked City was one of the first films shot on location in Manhattan, and it's particularly interesting to watch it now in the light of the World Trade Center attacks. The opening sequence features terrific aerial shots of Manhattan while we hear this voiceover.
Ladies and gentlemen, the motion picture you are about to see is called The Naked City. My name is Mark Hellinger. I was in charge of its production. And I may as well tell you frankly that it's a bit different from most films you've ever seen. It was written by Albert Maltz and Malvin Wall, photographed by William Daniels, and directed by Jules Dassin. As you see, we're flying over an island, a city, a particular city. And this is a story of a number of people, and a story also of the city itself. It was not photographed in a studio. Quite the contrary. Barry Fitzgerald, our star, Howard Duff, Dorothy Hart, Don Taylor, Ted DeCorsia, and the other actors played out their roles on the streets, in the apartment houses, in the skyscrapers of New York itself. And along with them, a great many thousand New Yorkers played out their roles also. This is the city as it is. Hot summer pavements, the children at play, the buildings in their naked stone, the people without makeup. Well, let's begin our story this way. It's 1 o'clock in the morning on a hot summer night.
Last week, I asked director Jules Dassin why, at the age of 90, he came to New York for the Melina Mercouri retrospective in spite of the World Trade Center attack.
As soon as I heard about it, I had great need to be here. And my daughters, I live in Athens, my daughters live in Paris, and I said, I'm going. And they said, not without us. And all three of us reserved, booked flights, and came.
I want to talk a little bit about your 1948 movie, Naked City, which I believe was the first movie shot on location in New York.
No, it was not the first.
Not the first?
But I think maybe the first all of it, both interiors and exteriors in New York.
Now, in the opening, there are great scenes of Manhattan. Some of those shots seem to be shot from above, maybe from a helicopter?
From a little plane.
From a little plane.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the feeling of it?
Well, I tell you, I was raised in New York from the time I was 3 till I went to live in California for a while. And it's my city, it's my town, and I love it. This is the New York that I thought, and isn't it interesting, I thought I knew New York. But you learn a city when you're really going to film it and you have to walk it all. And you find out all the secrets of how a city is fed and how the dead are buried in the hospital systems and all the things that the organizational life of a city, the simplicity of the planning. When I was much younger, I was very unhappy that streets were calling First Street, Second, Third, and Fourth, whereas in Europe you had Mozart Avenue and Beethoven Alley and so on. But here, I didn't find any poetry in the numbers. But then understanding that grid system, I thought it was just brilliant planning.
Did shooting The Naked City make you feel even more attached to Manhattan than you'd felt before?
Yes. Yes. Because there was this passionate interest that sometimes became huge problems because the camera and actors attract people, and we had to use all kinds of techniques to hide the camera. I had a portable newspaper kiosk with me. I put the camera inside. I had a flower delivery van with a mirror that looks out. And most of all, I had a marvelous actor guy who, when the crowd would gather, and they learned before, when we came to shooting place, the crowds were already there. They had checked with hotels or who, where actors were, and they knew where we would be. And sometimes I would turn up and there'd be hundreds of people, literally. And this actor friend was very important to us because about a few blocks away, we would set up a ladder. He would get up on the ladder, wave an American flag, and begin to agitate. And people would rush to him, and I'd get my shots quickly and get out.
That's really funny. So you had an actor who was a decoy.
That's right.
And you were able to shoot undercover because you were hidden in this portable kiosk or in the flower, well, flower truck.
And such situations, there was no place to hide the camera. That's when we used our public speaker.
That's really great.
Yes.
Film director and actor Jules Dassin is my guest. A few years after you made Naked City, you were blacklisted. How did you know that you were blacklisted?
I think I read it in a newspaper. I had been invited to come to make a film in Italy, and I didn't work out. We agreed to disagree. And while I was in Rome, I decided I would go to the Cannes Film Festival. And when I was there, I learned that I had been enlisted into this noble brigade of refugees and subversive characters.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to go right back to the U.S. states. But I was waiting to be called, and was not for a while. And then I was engaged to, because New York did not admit a blacklist. The theater would not be intimidated. And I was engaged to direct, of all things, a musical revue starring Betty Davis. And I couldn't understand why she wanted to do that, but she did. And I said, fine, because it was a job. And went into rehearsal. And only after rehearsals had maybe, I think we'd gone to about 2 weeks or so, a fellow turned up with the, what do you call, a subpoena to come to Washington to testify. And I was very frustrated because I said, well, I can't go now. I have the responsibility of this play. They'll have to wait, and they'll have to wait for quite a time because we're going to take it out of town, you know, as you try these plays before you bring them to New York. And this guy who served these subpoenas became a buddy. He came to these different cities and said, hey. He would call me Julie. Hey, Julie, you're in trouble. You better go. And I said, I will not discharge I have this responsibility, and I'm going to finish. And I'll be in Washington the very next day. And a day or two before we opened in New York, there's a telegram that came signed, and they said, these hearings have been indefinitely postponed. So I never got to make my heroic speech. Frustration.
My guest is film director Jules Dassin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Jules Dassin. He directed Night in the City, Brute Force, Rafifi, Top Kappi, and Never on Sunday. He was blacklisted a few years after he made the 1948 film, The Naked City. You ended up making your next movie in France. Had it become impossible to work in the United States?
It became impossible because I knew once I was named as a subversive, and that I understood the blacklist had by that time been well entrenched. There was no work, and people avoided you. Friends would pretend they didn't see you, and I had a family to feed. And I was offered a film in France, a film with the actor, their great comic actor's name is Fernandel. And I grabbed it, leaped at it. A few days before, no, about a week before, we were to shoot, the actress whom we had hired, an American actress, came weeping, said, "I have been told if I work with Mr. Dassin, I will never get a job in America again, and so I'm obliged to leave. Excuse me, I'm out." And this gave the producer a little bit of a shock. But I said, "Well, we can cast that again." We began to do that, and then he got another message from a man whose name I'll tell you, know his name, I'll never forget it, Mr. Roy Brewer, who was the president of the technicians union in California. And his message to the producer was that if you make this film with Mr. Dassin, it will never see a release in the States, nor will any film you ever make from then on be released in the States. And they took this threat seriously, and I was out of a job. And that went on for about 4 years until Rififi came up.
And Rififi is just a brilliant, now classic, heist movie. And let me read something Francois Truffaut said about it. He said, "Out of the worst crime novel I have ever read, Jules Dassin has made the best film noir I have ever seen." Were you skeptical of making the novel into a movie? Did you dislike the novel as much as Truffaut did?
I was not enchanted by it. But it was a job.
You wanted to work.
And there was just this section of the novel, which was about a heist, a robbery. And I decided to make the film, build it around that. So all of the themes, ideas, and some racist notions in the book, I did not have to face. As a matter of fact, I became friends with the writer, the author of the book later on. But it was so glorious and wonderful to work again after 5 years.
So, I guess the exhilaration of working again is part of what we're seeing in the movie.
I hope so. I would be glad if that were true.
The most famous scene in Rififi is the actual jewelry heist. This is a scene of close to 30 minutes. There's no dialogue and there's no music.
No.
As these guys work without making a sound.
That's right.
Why did you shoot it without dialogue or music?
I just felt it that way, and I think it came from my trust in the characters as written and as played. They had no need to talk or communicate. They were professionals. They knew each other. They anticipated each other, and they knew that noise was an enemy. Noise was dangerous, and they worked quietly, efficiently, and in touch with each other, contact that was very strong. And it worked better in the silence.
Now, most filmmakers, I think, would have put music underneath, suspense music or some kind of music.
Oh, I think then you've heard my story, a story. There's a wonderful composer in French history, as a matter of fact. His name is Georges Auric, who also did film work. He's written some marvelous stuff for movies. And he said, I look forward to writing music for this huge sequence. And I said, no, I don't want music. He said, you're mad. You're mad. And the producer said, you're mad. You're going to go 30 minutes without dialogue, without music? I said, that's what I hope. And he said, look, I'm your friend. I'm going to cover you. I'm going to write the music. I said, I don't want it. I'm going to write it. And he did, almost a symphony. And this wonderful guy, I invited him. I said, come to screening. I'm going to show you the film once with music and once without music. And I want you to tell me what you think I should do. And he sat through both versions and he said, music out. Wonderful guy.
Now, do you think that audiences early on realized that there was no sound and dialogue? Or did it just work on them unconsciously?
Well, I trapped them a little bit because there was one sound I did make. The guy accidentally touches a piano key. And when I saw that with an audience and they gasped, when he made that sound, I said, okay, we're in. They don't want him to make any noise.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film director and actor Jules Dassin. I'm going to quote François Truffaut. He wrote, the relative permissiveness of the French censors allowed Dassin to make a film without compromises, immoral perhaps, but profoundly tragic, warm, human. Now, I think one of the immoral, quote, parts that he's referring to is a scene in which the main character, Le Stéphanois, played by Jean Servais, has just gotten out of prison, and he discovers that his old girlfriend is now with his enemy. So he punishes her by forcing her to strip, then whipping her with a belt, and throwing her out the door before she can zip her dress back up. We never see her undressed, nor do we see him actually whip her. We just hear it. And we also see how disgusted he is by his own act when he's through whipping her. How did you decide how to shoot that scene?
Well, may I correct one thing?
Yeah.
He did not come to punish an enemy. He didn't even know who the man was. When he went to prison, this woman, very, very sympathetic character, as a matter of fact, just had to take up another life. And Servais, the character who was prison, I thought, felt, as did the actor, that he behaved cruelly. But that's the way that he would behave. And it was, the cruelty was suggested more than seen.
Right.
As a matter of fact, not a single scratch or blow was filmed. It was suggested.
But I understand that the movie ended up on the Legion of Decency list of movies to avoid, and that it was actually censored in some countries.
Look, the Legion of Decency, I'm convinced, treated it that way because my name was on the film.
Right.
Something I have some pride about was that after people who needed work, friends, blacklisted people, talent people that I knew about, had to work under false names. And I just, when Rififi was seen by American distributors, it had already opened in Europe and was very successful, made a lot of money. And producers of the States, distributors, came to me and offered me a lot of money. if I would remove my name from the film and put up some false name that I refused. And that was the first film made by a former blacklistee that had the director's name on it. This is credited to my dear friend Dalton Trumbo, who made Spartacus.
Right, that's the story I always hear.
No, but that came after Rififi, considerably later. And with my name on it, all we got at the beginning was one theater in New York, one. But it opened and was very successful, and so some other theaters took it up. But it got very limited distribution at the time.
I know you acted in the Yiddish theater in New York before you even directed. What kinds of parts did you play in the Yiddish theater?
I actually played one speaking part because I was an apprentice in that theater. And I played the lead in one part because I was the understudy. And I stepped in, and I was great. And then the next day, I was terrible. And the third day, I was just inadmissible. And I said, oh, my God, you mean one has to do this every night? I said, no more actors for me. And that's when I decided to go in another direction.
Was Yiddish your first language?
Well, actually, it's very strange. My mother and father were Jewish, but my father insisted that we speak in English. And so I didn't. I spoke sub-Yiddish, but not well. But when I saw that theater and said, I want to be in this theater, because I think it was a great theater called the Artef, marvelous, wonderful theater with a brilliant director, a man whose name is Benno Schneider. And I said, oh, I was a boy, I was very young, but I said, I want to be part of this theater. And part of it was studying Yiddish.
Oh.
And I spent almost five, 6 years in that theater. Happy, happy time.
My guest is film director Jules Dassin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Jules Dassin. Now, Jules Dassin, you two of your best known movies, Never on Sunday and Top Cappy, starred Melina Mercouri, who also you were married to for many years. She passed away in 1994, and she became Minister of Culture in Greece. But before that had happened, she was exiled for several years after a military coup. And then she was voted into parliament. Then she became Minister of Culture. Mm-hmm. Did you become a couple before you started working together, or did you become a couple through working together?
Both. She at a Cannes Festival in 1954 or 55. Melina came with a film representing Greece, a film called Stella, and I came representing France with Rififi, and we met there. And I admired her performance very much in Stella, that was the title of the film, and I was preparing another film called He Who Must Die, in which there's a part that I thought she would be perfect for. And I told her about that, and that's how our life began.
What was her image in Greek movies before Never on Sunday, in
she
which she played a kind of earthy prostitute?
In Never on Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah. She had made only that one film before. This film, Stella, was the first film she ever made.
Oh.
That's all she had. It was her first movie.
So you kind of discovered her in a way.
Well, the man who made Stella discovered her. But she was a very important star in the Greek theater.
Now, you've continued to live in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about living in that country? I guess your family is there now.
No. My family is in Paris. But, you know, we see each other. My daughters are here with me now, right outside your studio door. You know, this dictatorship that you referred to lasted 7 years.
In Greece?
Yeah, it lasted 7 years. And for Melina to be cut away from Greece, which she passionately loved. She loved everything Greek. If you had a Greek name, she loved you. She was a nationalist, a jingoist, a chauvinist, whatever came to Greek, she loved. And for her to be away was very serious punishment. And when the junta fell, I happened to be in New York on the day it happened. And Melina was in Paris. And she said, I'm going back tomorrow. Think of what you're going to do and let me know. And I had said to myself, now, I'm thinking of my work mostly. My Greek was practically non-existent, limited. And I had to decide quickly what I would do the rest of my life. But I knew what Greece meant to Melina. She had to be there. And I knew what she meant to me, so I had to be with her. And that was the decision. I went to live in Greece.
Well, Jules Dassin, thank you for talking with us. Thank you for visiting New York.
Enjoy talking to you.
And I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Film director Jules Dassin, last week he flew to New York for a film retrospective featuring his late wife, Melina Mercouri. It runs at the Film Forum in Manhattan through October 18th. He will appear at the Harvard Film Archive October 11th, where they're doing a tribute to Mercouri and Dassin. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, stories of the men who raised the American flag at Iwo Jima during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Osama bin Laden has said America will not live in peace before peace reigns in Palestine. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with former Senator George Mitchell. He recently headed an international panel examining the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.